wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job, and I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will still welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The master told him, "Take your bill, have it." And then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill, make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Now, this is a hard parable. It's confusing because in the telling of the story, the owner of the estate brings his manager in, and he intends to fire him, but he then tells him what he's going to do. The manager goes out and writes off a lot of the debts that are owed to the estate, and it makes the manager look good, but it costs the owner of the estate, and yet the owner of the estate ends up commending this shrewd but crooked manager for the way he has feathered his own nest. The even more important question is, what is Jesus teaching us? What does this parable have to say to you and I? Unfortunately, this is not one of those where the disciples come up to him and ask him later and say, "What did you mean by that?" and where we have the full explanation of the parable. I wish we did. Many of the parables are about the nature of the kingdom, and Jesus will say the kingdom of heaven is like this. He doesn't do that in this parable. There are those parables where we are given an example to emulate so that we can go and do likewise. That's certainly not the case with this particular parable. Now, there are a couple of points that I want to make. I don't believe, first of all, that Jesus is suggesting that we use underhanded business practices, even though that's what the main character in this story does. I don't think he's saying that we cover up one wrong by committing a second fraudulent act. In this parable, as in other parables, Jesus frequently uses dubious characters to illustrate truths without necessarily commending the behavior of those dubious characters. There are some villains in the parables of Jesus. He tells about a thief who breaks in to steal in one of his parables. He talks about a judge in another parable that cares not about God or man. And he's not commending the behavior of those individuals. A second point is that it doesn't say that his master praised his dishonesty in the telling of this parable. He praised his shrewdness. And that's a really important designation that we want to see here. Barclay suggests that it was a cynical appreciation by a master who had been conned by a master con man. Maybe that's the case. Now, having told the story, notice the points that Jesus does make from this parable, because he tells the parable and then he makes some application. That will go a long way toward helping us understand what Jesus was doing with this parable. Look at the last part of verse 8 there. It says, "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light." Now, that's one of the points that Jesus makes in this parable. You know, if Christians were as ambitious about pursuing their spiritual goals as people of this world are ambitious about pursuing their worldly goals, Christians would be a lot further ahead than the people of this world are ahead in their pursuits. You know, almost daily We hear about people who make tremendous sacrifices for things that are absolutely ungodly. I mean, there are people that are willing to blow themselves up for their fanatical causes. We read about revolutionaries who live a life on the run, and they're willing to live in poverty and live a horrible existence on this earth for some misguided cause. Hugh Martin wrote about so many Christians who are only nominal in their Christianity. They're unwilling to make sacrifices that we see people in this world making to get ahead in areas that won't even matter for eternity. He wrote, "If they took as much trouble, if they took as much trouble with their Christianity as they do in trying to reduce their handicap at golf or in growing their roses, they would be much better people spiritually." So Jesus is not commending this dishonest steward as an example for us to emulate in our shady business ethics. He's simply holding him out as an example. Here's a man who saw what was coming, and he took drastic measures to prepare for what is coming. Now, that's the lesson for us. We are to take measures. We know life is short. We know what is at the end of this life. We know that there is judgment. We know that all we have is temporary. And yet, for many Christians, you wouldn't know it by the way we tend to feather our nests and make ourselves as comfortable as possible. You might even think that some folks intend to just live here on this earth forever. Jesus says, use what you have and use it wisely, because there is an end in sight to all of this. Now, the second point that Jesus makes is here in verse 9. Look again there. He says, "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." The manager used his wealth in order to create friendships. He had a lot of friendships. By the time he was done with his shrewd dealing, he brought all the debtors in, and he discounted their bills. Now, when he was ready to go out and take his next job selling life insurance or whatever he did, he was able to go out there, and these were all of his friends now in the community. He had done them a big favor, and he could expect some kind of a return. He'd be welcomed into their homes. So he takes care of himself. He worked quickly, and he worked cleverly to ensure his material comfort in this world. He couldn't dig ditches. He didn't want to beg. And so he ensured his future prosperity in this way. Now, Jesus is saying to his followers, use what you have for an eternal future. This man worked shrewdly to ensure a temporary future. As Christians, we need to use our material wealth to prepare and work quickly for the eternity that stands before us. Use your money to bless your fellow man. And then one day we'll stand before God, and one of the measures, according to Jesus, for those who are invited to come in, the sheep and the goats, are those who have blessed their fellow man, who visited those, you know, who are in prison, and who've helped those who are naked, and fed those who are hungry. Later in this very same chapter, Jesus will tell another story about a rich man and a poor beggar named Lazarus. And if that rich man had followed this advice of Jesus and responded in a more empathetic way and moved more quickly to ease the needs of Lazarus, then Lazarus, the story would have ended very differently. Lazarus would have welcomed that rich man into the same paradise that he enjoyed. But as the story ends, that man Lazarus is not even able to cross over and as much as give him a drop of water to cool his tongue in torment. Jesus also in Matthew 25 tells that story of the sheep and the goats and talks about the response to our fellow man. Now, the final point is seen in the verses that actually follow this parable. We've not looked at those yet, but look at those. And I think Jesus explains his point in this section. Verse 10, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? So Jesus asked this question about how we have handled our money. Now, we all know that money in terms of eternity is nothing. I don't care if you are a billionaire. That's nothing in light of eternity. Whatever we amass in this world will all be destroyed. It'll all be burned up. But the way we view money is a very important barometer of our heart and where our true affections lie. It reveals much about what our priorities are in this life and what we anticipate in the life to come. How we use our money is a measure of our faithfulness, and it determines in part our fitness for the greater wealth of the kingdom. Now, the lesson from my understanding of this particularly difficult parable is that God wants us to invest our money wisely in kingdom business and not just in temporary things that won't last. And so he gives us this example of a man who worked to care for his needs on a temporary basis, and he urges us to use our funds in a wise way, investing in things that will last for all of eternity as we anticipate that time that comes. Now, Jesus closes out this section with a direct challenge to a group of wealthy religious folks who were caught up in materialism. Listen to what he says to those folks beginning in verse 13. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight." You know, in a very real sense, if I'm going to place myself somewhere in this story, I'm not the wealthy landowner. I'm probably that steward. That's the role I would find myself in. And the charge that was made against that steward might just be made against me. That steward was wasting the master's possessions. And in a very real sense of the word, you and I have been given a stewardship during our short sojourn on this earth. Anything we possess does not ultimately belong to us. And there have been times that I have done this, and so I feel fairly confident in assuming that some of you have done the same thing. There have been times when I have wasted what's been entrusted to my stewardship. There are times when I have been overly self-indulgent. There have been times when I have fallen prey to the god of materialism. There have been times when I've just flat out been selfish in using what God has blessed me with. And I know that one day we'll be called in before our master, just as this steward was called in, to give an accounting. And I really wish that I had the eyes always to see things as clearly and with the discernment that unjust steward saw things with. When the master finally called him in, I mean, he got busy in a hurry. And I wish that I had the same sense of urgency as I look toward the last years that remain in my life on this earth in using all the resources that God has placed at my disposal to invest in the kingdom and to honor Him. He saw clearly, this man did in the parable, what was at stake, and he prepared for his future. And I think that's the moral of the story. We must prepare likewise for ours. The story is told about a sailor who was shipwrecked in the South Seas, and he was rescued by a group of islanders who made him their king, and he was treated as royalty. He enjoyed every luxury imaginable. But he came to learn what happens to people who are made king. At the end of a year, they get a new king. And the old king is put out on a desert island miles away from the main island. And they are left there all on their own to die a death of starvation. And so once he learned that story, he began to send boatloads of material to that far island. And he had a beautiful house built. And he populated that island. And he planted crops on that island. So at the end of the year, when it came time for him to lose his kingship on the main island, as he was banished off to the far island, he was banished not to a barren island and awaiting death, but he was banished to a paradise. For you and I, in many ways, we are like kings here on this earth. Kings for a short time, in that we're able to choose what we will do and how we will use our resources. But Jesus gives strong advice to those who loved material things there in his age. Also in Matthew chapter 6, and I want to close with this passage, Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." It all boils down to a heart issue. That's what he said to these men. God sees your heart. Tonight, if there's anyone that we can assist, either through prayer or assist you as you respond in faith to Jesus, we'll gladly hear your confession and see you enter the waters of baptism and leave here a forgiven person. You know, Jesus talked to his disciples about a rich man and the eye of a needle. And the bottom line is really this: none of us are capable on our own of overcoming the materialistic pull of this world. Only God can change hearts and cause us to be rich towards him. And I'm grateful for that. If you're subject to the invitation, we invite you to come tonight as we stand and sing.